This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Law Opens Door for IT Product Vendors. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. A new state program will buy used computers and other IT products for thousands of state and municipal workers only from vendors certified to put the equipment back into good-as-new condition. But the two major agencies involved, the State Office of Information Technology and the Department of Administration, will have to come up with rules to clarify exactly how vendors will go about getting a piece of the business. It will be up to the Administration Department to lay out the bidding procedures. Department spokesman Chris Meir says his agency is still studying the new law. North Carolina Chief Information Officer Chris Estes has been directed to keep track of the cost savings and equipment reliability. Legislators who drafted the program say the state can cut its IT costs, which hit $1.44 billion last year, by giving state departments, UNC system schools, community colleges, and local governments the option of buying refurbished computers and other types of IT equipment. The enabling legislation spells out what types of used equipment can be resold, including desktops, notebooks or laptops, monitor or video display units, keyboards, mice, other peripheral equipment, printers, scanners, and combination printer-scanner fax machines. It also spells out who can bid on the work. Only companies certified by the original manufacturers to restore pre-owned computer equipment to the point where the equipment meets original warranty and software licensing requirements. Like other large North Carolina cities, Raleigh has plenty of companies that fix computers for individual customers. Some even keep a small stock of refurbished PCs and Macs on their shelves for resale. But for bulk, I think the state might have to turn to the original equipment manufacturers, says Mark Rose of Raleigh-based DataFirst. Dell, Hewlett-Packard, and others have divisions that deal in refurbished products and at a discount. Still, some IT industry observers speculate that bulk suppliers other than the OEMs might be persuaded to enter the market over time if the state's demand for refurbished PCs and other IT equipment remains strong. The legislative framers want state and local governmental and educational agencies to keep track of the cost savings that result from buying used equipment. They also want state CIO Estes to compile those cost-saving estimates into a lump figure and report it quarterly to the General Assembly's Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Information Technology. If the program is successful, small businesses across the state may face new opportunities to do business with the government. And moving down the page from that article, the cover story in this edition of Triangle Business Journal has the headline, Business of Fear. Area firms are working on multi-million dollar deals with the feds to counter bioterrorism threats. And this article is written by Lauren Onsorge with the Dateline of Durham. In a sterile lab at an undisclosed location, a scientist in a biohazard suit holds a tiny vial containing the worst nightmare, a pathogen that, in not-so-careful hands, could release what experts call a doomsday scenario, a germ that could infect your mother, your husband, your child. In the past 9/11 world, in the post-9/11 world, the most deadly weapons might be smaller than a nuclear bomb, a lot smaller, and the outcomes? Apocalyptic. That's the growing fear of bioterrorism, a weapon that, even in the age of government cuts, remains an integral defense investment. While biological warfare isn't new, in medieval times, diseased corpses were thrown over castle walls. What is new is the intent. Of the diseased corpses, Duke University's Carol Pumphrey, a professor of medieval history, says, even this, though, clearly biological warfare, probably should not be defined as terrorism since its purpose was not so much to create terror as to undermine the abilities of the enemy to hold out. In the new age of unpredictable warfare, the motives have changed. So have the warriors. Instead of armored soldiers fighting an onslaught with swords and cannons, they are scientists draped in protective gear. And the marching orders? Increasingly, they're coming from triangle companies creating what, worst case scenario, could be one of the last frontiers in medical countermeasures to what is becoming common in the vernacular, germ warfare. But even the most advanced treatments are several years and tens of millions of dollars away from being utilized in an actual emergency. Still, scientists press on, expecting the worst, and profiting, in the meantime, from fear-fueled government grants. Since 2001, the U.S. government, through 11 separate agencies, has allocated some $50 billion to address the threat of bioweapons. Chimerix's battle against smallpox. Among those getting some of that money is Durham company Chimerix, whose early-stage antiviral is commercially being developed as a candidate to fight viruses in immunocompromised transplant patients. But, and this is a big but, it also is being researched as a last-stand defense against a smallpox outbreak. Dubbed CMX-001, the antiviral is being developed both as a treatment and as a preventative therapeutic against all five strands of double-stranded DNA viruses, of which smallpox, a typical target of conspiracy theorists, is a member. Barry Bleckman, co-founder of the Stimson Center, a nonpartisan peace and security think tank in Washington, D.C., says the disease is commonly regarded as one with biothreat potential. We know the Russians, and the U.S. for that matter, had been experimenting with smallpox as biological weapons, Bleckman says. And CMX-001 has potential to be the first antiviral agent approved to treat the disease that, while eradicated in humans, is classified as a Category A bioterror agent by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's what we call a dual-use agent, says Chimerix CEO Ken Mock of CMX-001. And while traditional investors stand to profit from a transplant commercial use, monetary profit from the bioterrorism indication relies on the fear of an enemy attack using the smallpox virus. That's where the government financing comes in. In June of 2013, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, a government agency with the acronym BARDA, BARDA, extended its contract by $5 million for Chimerix to conduct animal studies over the next year. We look at this from the standpoint that it's the possibility of saving many, many lives should there be a bioterrorism event, Mock says. Proceeding with care. But in testing efficacy against an eradicated disease, there are complications. That's why the Food and Drug Administration has implemented what it calls the animal rule, a route of animal testing instead of conducting human trials. It makes it both easier and harder simultaneously, Mock says of the rule. Translation, the money makes it happen, but the rules make it happen more slowly. Honestly, our commercial activities now are moving at a faster pace than the smallpox-related activities, he says. It's choices of government funding. Chimerix is far from alone. At an increasing clip, the U.S. government is investing countermeasure cash in triangle companies. Chapel Hill antibiotic developer Sempra, having nabbed guaranteed funding of $17.7 million over 2 years, extendable for a 5-year total of $58 million, is another player. The company is putting its BARDA cash toward a new drug application for the use of its solithromycin against bioterror pathogens such as anthrax and tularemia, and Research Triangle Park-based BioCryst, which already nabbed BARDA funds for its flu treatment, is hoping to net its own tax dollar-infused grant for a preclinical antiviral treatment. Bigger companies are even bigger players in the preparation for battle, evidenced by an initial $40 million BARDA infusion into GlaxoSmithKline's antibiotic pipeline. The sum could total up to $200 million for the company, which has its North American headquarters in RTP, should the agreement be renewed over 5 years. That project aims to come up with a treatment for traditional antibiotic-resistant pathogens as well as biothreats such as anthrax and plague. David Payne, head of GSK's Antibacterial Discovery Performance Unit, calls the public-private partnership vital in offsetting what could come should worst fears be realized. And a scientist's fears can surpass science fiction, a worst-case scenario being addressed by GSK, pathogens that are antibiotic-resistant. You could make these biothreats resistant to the currently available antibiotics, and that would be a big problem, says Payne. There's a huge unmet medical need. Just think about the conventional bacterial pathogens. There are scenarios now that we're told about where doctors are running out of new antibiotics. Throw an antibiotic-resistant weapon into the mix, a weapon such as antibiotic-resistant anthrax, already designated as a threat by U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and the result could be unstoppable without new treatments. The big problem? The treatments in development are years and millions of dollars away from making an impact. Drug discovery has an element of unpredictability to it, Payne says. As you hit more and more challenges, you don't know if something is going to happen along the way. GSK's most developed molecule is just nearing the end of phase 1 development in a field where three phases are required before an application for a treatment can even be submitted to federal regulators for review. Each phase can take years and cost millions of dollars. And even if bioterror threats can wait, the research focuses on what is already identified, anthrax, smallpox, plague. But what if the world's next terror threat is something entirely new? The question becomes, how do you prepare a counterattack to a threat that doesn't yet exist? Colonel Ron Hahn, an Army officer and acting director of the Joint Science and Technology Office for Chemical and Biological Defense at the United States Department of Defense, says DOD determines if we can use a platform against a threat we've already identified. Sometimes the same treatments can work for a variety of ailments. His hope is that even if the DNA sequencing is engineered differently, the symptoms could be similar to what's already identifiable and likewise treated. The technology is independent of the pathogen, he explains. In most cases, it doesn't matter if it's flu or plague or anthrax, the technology will work against all of them. But what if it's not? What if what the world should be afraid of is an as-yet-to-be-conceived virus capable of surpassing our science fiction fears? Experts advise leaving those kinds of fears at the movie theater. Take Bill Gentry, a professor at the University of Carolina at Chapel Hill, who trains public officials to respond to bioterror scenarios. For a weaponized high-density effect event, I think there is a low percentage for that now, he says. But for a backyard terrorism-type person who can make ricin or develop some anthrax from naturally occurring agents, I think we'll continue to see those on a year-to-year basis. But they'll only be affecting a very small, targeted number of people. But what if? You can what if an event to death, Gentry says. That's what scientists should be doing. And in a word of solace to those who do worry about the what ifs, he says, preparedness is occurring at a level that the average citizen isn't aware of. And it's increasing every day because the very same businesses profiting from the fear are ever conscious of the dangers. We have no choice, says Mock of the mission. I think we have to be prepared whether we like it or not. It's a sentiment shared by the director of BARDA, Robin Robinson. It's unacceptable not to be prepared, to not have those medical countermeasures in place when something disastrous happens, he says. It's that something disastrous that constantly keeps scientists vigilant. I believe there are a lot of bad people out there, and you only need one to do a bad thing, Mock says. I'm not particularly comfortable with the world we live in, so it is a driving force. I do not have comfort that people can show restraint. And the scientists are typically more afraid than the average citizen. Citizens in North Carolina and really across the country are fairly desensitized to bioterror events, notes Gentry. What would it take for it to be commonplace fear? An actual attack, he says. And inside the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn now to a related article that's part of the cover story. The headline on this article, U.S. searches for solutions to counter biothreats. And this article is also written by Lauren Onsorge, with a dateline of Research Triangle Park. As scientists in Research Triangle Park and elsewhere work to create medical countermeasures to a biological attack, the United States is preparing for a doomsday scenario with multiple and often overlapping agencies scrambling to create solutions and come up with a plan. It's a highly theoretical preparation because a high-density bioterrorism event hasn't occurred. The government doesn't really know what to expect. The biggest threat projection? A weaponized pathogen that targets civilians. It would start sort of the way the swine flu epidemic started. A disease that begins in one place and as people travel it spreads, says Barry Bleckman, co-founder of nonpartisan peace and security think tank, the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. It's hard to pinpoint the source of that kind of terrorist attack. It would be harder than if they, say, used a nuclear weapon. But as hard as it would be to detect, a biological weapon could be much easier to make than a nuclear explosion. It doesn't require large facilities to manufacture the lethal material, Bleckman points out. You could do it essentially in a kitchen if you had a protective suit and safety equipment to ensure that you weren't contaminating your immediate environment. And while ricin and anthrax are obvious weapons of choice because recipes are easily accessible on the internet, The doomsday scenario is more complicated, Blechman adds. That someone would genetically modify some kind of lethal bug in a way that would make it completely resistant to antibiotics or whatever else was involved. And as scientists prepare their compounds, the non-medical arm of the government is mobilizing as well, with specialized sensors that try to detect the existence of deadly microbes. While Blechman doubts their effectiveness, it's not the only monitoring method. I'm sure the NSA, National Security Agency, is very alert to this kind of danger, he says. Colonel Ron Hand, director of the Joint Science and Technology Office for Chemical and Biological Defense at the United States Department of Defense, says the government is anything but passive, with protocols in place to immediately address a threat. The first step? Look toward developing a vaccine. That's part of the easiest way to address a threat, he notes, pointing to the fact that it requires little in the way of protective gear. Diagnostics and treatment exploration follow close behind. As a test, his team follows flu pandemics, such as a recent outbreak in China, pretending, so to speak, that it's a biological weapon threat. All the while, his team invests in research, typically partnerships with universities. Currently, 74 projects are happening at the basic research level. As technologies advance into industry, the government can increase its interest, leveraging its own limited dollars by partnering with a high-dollar pharma. If we could put a little DNA tag on everything we've worked on, we've got parts and pieces of a whole bunch of programs out there that end up getting commercialized, he says. And they rely on Big Pharma's investment as much as Big Pharma relies on government contracts. When big companies see a commercial application, they in turn leverage their much larger capital to further develop it. His team typically works with pre-Phase 1 technology and is one of multiple government agencies fixated on responding to the what-ifs of bioterrorism. Another big player is the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, an arm of the Department of Health and Human Services that was established in 2006 to support advanced development of medical countermeasures. Those medical countermeasures can be in the form of vaccines, therapeutics, medical devices, diagnostics, BARDA Director Robin Robinson says. The development pipeline is 135 candidates heavy, with about 11 products delivered into the national stockpile for bioterrorism, chemical, and nuclear threats. The agency nets rated threats from the Department of Defense and then looks at the medical consequences of the threats to decide on medical countermeasures. Next, BARDA puts out solicitations so that companies can seek funding for projects that address the needs. Then we acquire those products when those candidates become mature enough to be able to access those products under emergency use, Robinson says, adding that it takes about 13 years and about $1 billion to develop a product to industry standard. And while the pipeline is filling with potential countermeasures against most threats, there is one that has yet to be addressed, Ebola. The candidates out there are a little too early for us to invest in, he explains. Our ultimate goal is to be able to address all the threats provided to us through the Department of Homeland Security. And as the medical teams zero in on science clusters such as RTP, experts stateside are also rallying with the likes of Bill Gentry, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who trains public officials to respond to bioterror scenarios. It's really centered around the public response service agencies, he says, adding that it begins on the law enforcement side. We're a lot more prepared than we were before 2001, I can tell you that. A good measuring stick, he says, is an event itself, such as the 2001 anthrax events, when envelopes with spores of the deadly pathogen were delivered to media outlets and government officials. The 2001 anthrax events were a wake-up call. While North Carolina was very good in dealing with natural disasters, the 2001 anthrax events really brought in focus that we weren't as prepared for a biological event, says Gentry. Since then, awareness has fueled state and federal funding, making him reasonably confident in his state's ability to respond to a small-scale anthrax attack. But a large-scale engineered biologics attack? I really couldn't tell you how prepared we are for that because, obviously, in my lifetime, we've never had to deal with one of those particular outbreaks, Gentry says. So you don't know how rapidly it's going to spread and what the public response is going to be. We try to prepare for that by doing exercises and by doing modeling, but without a real event to really base training and preparedness on, it makes those types of agents a little harder to gauge preparedness. And now we turn to the biz section, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings. No more construction bids for D.H. Griffin. Word on the street is the D.H. Griffin Construction Company in Raleigh is dismantling its construction business in the Triangle and across the state and will be shifting most of its work to competitor company Balfour Beatty. D.H. Griffin Construction, a division that the Greensboro-based D.H. Griffin Demolition Company formed in 1995, has reached a deal with Balfour Beatty to sell all of its backlog of construction work, including the projects in which D.H. Griffin was hired as construction manager at risk and the projects in which it is working as a joint venture partner. D.H. Griffin Construction had in February broken ground on the new Student Health Center at North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro, and it also has been working on several school construction projects in both the Triangle and Charlotte regions. Balfour Beatty is an international general contracting firm that ranked number 2 among the largest construction firms in the Triangle in 2012 and employs about 70 people at its office in Raleigh. In a separate deal, Dave Hurley, president and managing member of D.H. Griffin Construction Company, is planning to start his own company that will be focused on civil engineering and construction work. Rex Breast Care moves ops to Durley Road. The Rex Breast Care Center has moved to a new space at 3100 Durley Road. The new facility is 3 times larger than the previous center and is designed with more privacy features, Wi-Fi connectivity, and accessible parking. The new Rex Breast Care Center features screening and diagnostic tools, including digital mammograms, breast ultrasounds, ultrasound-guided core needle biopsy, stereodactic breast biopsy, and bone density tests. What is a virtual wine tasting event? You've heard of virtual learning, a trend utilized by more and more universities, but what about virtual tasting? Biz has learned that Washington, D.C. area retailer Total Wine & More is doing just that, a virtual wine tasting at stores from California to the East Coast, including its 2 Raleigh locations. Biz caught up with Edward Cooper, Vice President of Public Affairs and Community Relations for Total Wine, who says the California winery Camus Vineyards owner Chuck Wagner is going to walk participants of a webcast through a tasting of his 2011 Cabernet Sauvignon. As far as I know, it's the first time that any retailer has done this nationally, he says. This tasting is scheduled for Saturday, June 29, and more virtual tastings are planned in stores. Local companies make best places for IT list. Looking for a job in IT? 2 of IDG Computer World's best places to work in IT are headquartered here, privately held SAS of Cary and Durham-based Quintiles ranking 24 and 100 respectively. The top place to work? Detroit-based Quicken Loans. Other companies with Triangle presences ranked highly, such as Qualcomm, number 8, and Monsanto, number 25. Senduit acquisition means new jobs in RTP. Mark Taggart couldn't be more thrilled that his Scotland-based company, Patient Reminders, is being acquired by Durham's Senduit, a joint venture between Quintiles and Thermo Scientific. Senduit is pretty much a global company, he says, counting off its presences in Pennsylvania, Switzerland, and India. Good business isn't the only reason he's excited. An avid outdoorsman, Taggart is excited about anything involving good weather, he says. He looks forward to exploring the RTP area while maintaining residences in both Scotland and France. Patient Reminders will keep a presence in Scotland, but the headquarters and the bulk of the new hires will be in RTP. The plan is to have this taken care of by the high-quality teams and processes that are in Senduit already and look to expand those, he says. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Jason DeBrun, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we return to full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, Holly Springs pegs $5.6 million impact of new ballpark. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Holly Springs. A new Holly Springs ballpark won't hit the top end of its economic impact figures unless each visitor contributes $146.17 to the local economy on each trip. That's every man, woman, and child visiting the ballpark. So an Apex family of 4 going to a collegiate ball game in Holly Springs would have to contribute $584.69 to the Holly Springs economy in one trip. The town took that economic impact figure directly from the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, which arrived at the impact per visit by looking at visitor spending in the county as a whole. According to that research, 11.6 million visitors contributed $1.7 billion to the Wake County's economy in 2011, or $146.17 per person. Holly Springs approved a $7 million project for an athletic complex that would include an 1,800-seat baseball stadium for a new Coastal Plain League baseball team. These teams are comprised of college players who play after the college season. The town touted an annual economic impact of between $3.9 million and $5.6 million. Holly Springs Director of Economic Development Jenny Mizell put out the impact report. In it, she estimates 25,200 visitors to baseball games and 13,190 visitors for other special events. She then multiplies those figures by the $146.17 that each visitor would contribute to the economy to arrive at $5.6 million. Mizell was not available to comment on the economic development impact study. That is much rosier than the impact is likely to be and is probably designed to be that way, says Mitch Kokai of Raleigh-based John Locke Foundation. In trying to justify this expenditure, the town is saying, look, in and of itself, this field doesn't make sense. It's not a core function of government, but look at all this economic impact you're going to have. A public relations specialist hired by the town to help promote the project sees things differently. Matt DeMargle, with Holly Springs-based 919 Marketing, points to the family demographics surrounding the stadium site. There are more than 9,000 households with a child at home in just a 5-mile radius of the stadium, and the median income of the population as a whole in that area is $100,000, according to market research. You really are selling affordable family entertainment, and having a high average of young families in your area is really a key indicator, DeMargle says. Here is a market where a team can be successful. Even if the town doesn't reach the high end of its economic impact estimates, DeMargle says it will reap more entertainment spending from town residents who often must travel outside the town for fun activities. Holly Springs doesn't have a lot in terms of entertainment, so we are capturing those entertainment dollars now spent here in the town, he says. Voters in Wilmington overwhelmingly voted down a baseball stadium project in November 2012, though that one would have cost $37 million and resulted in a tax increase, so it's not a perfect comparison. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we have Todd Cohen's column. The headline on the column, Teaming Up to Feed School Kids Across the Triangle This Summer. More than 4,000 students in Chatham County schools, or half the student population, are eligible for federally funded free or reduced lunches. To make sure those children get nutritious meals during the summer, a coalition of partner agencies, funders, and volunteers, led by the Chatham Outreach Alliance in Pittsburgh, provides 5 breakfasts and 5 lunches a week for 10 weeks for more than 1,000 children. Our program is designed to replace the meals they would have gotten were they in school during the summer, says Beth Budd, Executive Director of Chatham Outreach Alliance, or CORA. Like CORA, the Raleigh-based Interfaith Food Shuttle provides food during the summer for some of the 116,000 children in the 7 counties it serves who are eligible for free and reduced lunches at school. 5 days a week, for example, its program that trains unemployed and underemployed adults for culinary jobs prepares 75 lunches for children at the East Durham Children's Initiative and another 40 lunches for girls at Full Circles Foundation in Raleigh. Chatham Outreach Alliance. CORA, which launched the summer food program on a pilot basis in 2009 when it served 120 kids, works with more than 200 volunteers and aims to raise $140,000 to support the program this year. Although it recently learned that large statewide foundation had declined its application for a $20,000 grant. To get food into the hands of kids who need it in a county with over 700 square miles, CORA partners with 16 churches and other organizations that act as distribution sites. Another partner, Chatham Trades, a nonprofit in Siler City that hires and trains adults with developmental disabilities, receives the food, packages it into weekly boxes, and delivers it to the distribution sites. Transportation is a problem for a lot of families, Bud says. We try to get the food as close to the families as we can. Interfaith Food Shuttle. Each summer, the food shuttle identifies communities that are home to a lot of kids who need food, and it partners with agencies that provide activities for children and that work with volunteers who can help serve the food it provides, says Terry Hutter, Vice President for Food Service and Culinary Training at the Food Shuttle. In addition to its summer food programs for children, the Food Shuttle also buys or receives donations of fresh produce and loads it into its fleet of 13 refrigerated trucks, which deliver food to over 40 locations a month throughout the year, the seven counties it serves. We roll into a neighborhood and set up a market in partnership with local groups where people can shop for free for a few hours, says Cindy Sink, Director of Communications at the Food Shuttle. The agency also hopes over the summer to increase the number of locations it serves with its mobile food truck and through delivering prepared foods. We certainly need every organization that can be feeding children to join in, Hutter says. And now for nonprofit news. Jersey Mike's Subs raised nearly $80,000 for the V Foundation for Cancer Research in its Month of Giving campaign. Throughout March, all 24 Jersey Mike's Triangle locations raised money for the V Foundation, culminating in the gift. Nationwide, Jersey Mike's raised $1.7 million for 86 different charities. Since 2010, including proceeds from this year's Month of Giving campaign, Jersey Mike's locations throughout the country have raised almost $7 million for charities. Jan Ammons and Andy Ammons of Raleigh have established a nonprofit family foundation that will award grants to endeavors seeking to enhance local communities. The Jandy Ammons Foundation Incorporated is now accepting letters of inquiry for grants to be awarded for 2014 projects. Founded in November 2012, the foundation will concentrate on innovative, project-driven endeavors focused on enhancing wildlife habitats, park settings, educational surroundings, artistic installations, or Christian church mission projects. And in the People on the Move section, the Council for Entrepreneurial Development named Steve Weehy of SciQuest chairman of its 2013 to 2014 board of directors. David Spitz of Channel Advisor was named chair-elect. Other 2013 to 2014 CED officers include Helga Leftwich of Hutchison PLLC, secretary, David Hood of Ernst & Young, treasurer, and Eric Lindsay of Papas Ventures, immediate past chair. The following were named to the board of directors of the United Way of the Greater Triangle: Nancy Pekarik of GlaxoSmithKline, Matt Sejkowski, a Chapel Hill town councilman, and Bryson Powell of East West Partners Management Company. And now we turn to the reporter pages. The first one we come to is the page for Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. The headline on the first article, Developers Try New Plan for Chapel Hill Project, with a dateline of Chapel Hill. A new plan is emerging for the Glen Lennox apartment and retail complex in Chapel Hill. 5 years after its owners scrapped an ambitious plan to redevelop the site with hundreds of new residential units, shops, and office buildings. Artistic sketches show images of lush landscaping, wide sidewalks, and a mix of new buildings intermingled with renovated brick cottages, for which the 60-year-old community at the corner of U.S. 15501 and NC 54 is known. It is part of a compromise plan approved by the owners, led by Charlotte real estate firm Grubb Properties, Chapel Hill town leaders and the owners of neighboring properties, and businesses who had been opposed to Grubb's first concept plan for Glen Lennox. Rachel Russell, a preservation professional and a project manager for Grubb Properties, says they now hope to have a development agreement with the town approved within the next year so renovation and construction work can begin. It's a slow process, but we are moving forward, she says. About 20 people participated in a tour of Glen Lennox on June 22, and dozens more were expected to participate in a second tour on the property on June 27, as well as a public input session on June 26, led by a technical team of consultants hired by the town but paid by the developer. Built in 1953, Glen Lennox now has 440 apartment units within single-story cottage buildings, as well as a 26,032-square-foot retail center that is anchored by the popular restaurants Bin 54 and Jujube. Grub Properties had presented its first concept plan for the redevelopment in 2008. It would have replaced the shopping center and apartments with up to 900 new housing units, a hotel, grocery store, movie theater, office buildings, and three parking decks. But the plan triggered a backlash from neighbors near the property, and the Glen Lennox Area Neighborhood Conservation District was created to serve as a mediation group between the developers and neighboring property owners. The NCD plan approved in May 2012 aims to preserve the property's current street network, as well as several of the buildings to help maintain historical integrity of the site. It also aims to preserve many of the mature trees, provide landscape buffers for sensitive neighbors, and to serve as a guide to the transition of various density and building heights, among other guidelines. The proposed new land use would allow construction of new residential properties, both available for rent and for sale, a boutique-style inn, office space for a mix of small tenants and corporate users, and retail space with boutique shops and restaurants, but a limited number of anchor tenants, as well as parks and open space. And this page also includes a retail ticker. Whole Foods signs a lease extension to stay another 15 years at the Waverly Place Shopping Center on Kildare Farm Road in Kerry. Lilly Pulitzer opened a women's apparel store at the streets of South Point Mall in Durham on June 19. The Park West Village Retail Power Center on NC 54 in Mooresville is expected to add four fashion shops in early 2014, including Ulta Beauty, Chico's, White House Black Market, and Soma Intimates. Chatham Hill Winery reopens its tasting room and wine-making operations on June 29 after relocating from Mooresville to 8245 Chapel Hill Road in Kerry. Dollar Tree Incorporated is adding three more stores in the Triangle by the end of the fall, at Alexander Place Shopping Center on Briar Creek Parkway in Raleigh, at Mill Pond Village Shopping Center on Kildare Farm Road in Kerry, and at Northwoods Market Shopping Center on Maynard Road in Kerry. The convenience store operator Kangaroo Express opened its first exclusive quick-service restaurant concept called Aunt Em's Kitchen in the Triangle on June 22nd at its Mooresville gas station at 3610 Davis Drive. And finally, we have a short article, Obey Creek Venture Getting Mixed Signals. Glen Lennox isn't the only major development project in Chapel Hill that's expected to work its way through the town's new development agreement process this year. Obey Creek is a 120-acre mixed-use development project that East West Partners of Chapel Hill is planning across the main entrance into the Southern Village community on U.S. 15501. But, like Glen Lennox, Obey Creek has faced extra scrutiny from nearby property and business owners about its proposed density, as well as its potential impacts on the environment and traffic. As a result, East West Partners President Roger Perry says they, like Grub Properties at Glen Lennox, have also agreed to work with a team of technical consultants. The consultants have been hired by the town and are being paid by the developers to work through details of a development agreement and reach a compromise with neighbors and town leaders. "We've gotten mixed signals from the town, and we hope this process can sift that out," Perry says. "We have said our plan is not sacred. If it is in the best interest to modify the plans, such as moving some of the uses around, then we are open to those discussions." And now we turn to Lee Weisbecker's page. Weisbecker covers bank and state government. The headline on this article, "Details Emerge as North Carolina Redraws Plan for Commerce." A McCrory administration-backed bill, now working its way through the General Assembly, draws the legal framework for the public-private entity the new government wants to put in place to spearhead state economic development. The measure, S-127, spells out the major changes in store for the Department of Commerce and the powers being given to a nonprofit corporation that'll recommend shifts, development, policy, and help recruit new company. For example, heading up the nonprofit will be a 15-member operating board made up of private and public sector appointees. The legislation gives it the authority to make recommendations on the size of the cash grants used to lure corporate recruits to the state. But it will be left up to the Commerce Department's traditional grants-making committee to make the actual payouts. Moreover, the bill takes pains not to give the nonprofit any say over the operation of the state's unemployment insurance system of 8 specialized Commerce Department divisions, spanning range from the ABC Board to the Commission of Banks. The powers it is being given, on the other hand, appear to be chiefly advisory, including among them are duty to make suggestions on the use of existing but empty business space, guiding both the administration and General Assembly on policy questions, and formulating budget requests to keep the state's cash incentive programs well stocked. Introduced by Republican Harry Brown of Jacksonville and Bill Cook of Chocowinity, the measure has gone through a number of rewrites as it moved through the Senate and finally over to a House Appropriations Committee. It's the bill that makes the changes we want and the one we're following very closely, says Commerce Department spokeswoman Beth Gargan. Critics wonder, however, whether the cart isn't coming before the horse. What I've been waiting to hear is what their strategic objectives are for making the changes they are seeking, says Brett Lane of the UNC Chapel Hill Center for Competitive Economies. And so far, I've heard nothing about strategy or any acknowledgement that what we've been doing for the past 15 years in economic development has not been successful. One key question in the McCrory administration's new design is how the nonprofit's cooperation's 15-member operating board will be staffed. It'll be up to the governor to make 9 of the selections, including the chair. The Speaker of the North Carolina House and President of the Senate get to choose 3 each. As for McCrory's choices, the legislation directs that one appointee must come from an area of agribusiness, financial services, IT, life sciences, energy, manufacturing, military affairs, tourism, and retail or logistics. A paragraph on board member compensation apparently remains to be added to the bill. Any full-time employee hired by the nonprofit working with the Commerce Department can't receive more than $120,000 in state funds. What doesn't appear to have much of a future under the new organizational scheme are the state's 7 existing regional economic development partnerships, including the Research Triangle Regional Partnership. They were originally set up by an act of the General Assembly. Under the McCrory reorganization, that original authorization will be repealed, along with a cutoff of money. RTRP President Charles Hayes couldn't immediately be reached for comment. And the next reporter page is Jason DeBruns. DeBruns covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. The headline on the article, MLR rules result in consumer savings. North Carolina customers to receive $10 million in rebates. New rules on health insurance premiums seem to be providing at least some savings for consumers. As part of the Affordable Care Act, health insurance companies must spend between 80% and 85% of all premiums collected on actual medical claims, or refund the difference to policyholders. This is known as the medical loss ratio, or simply MLR. Nationwide, MLR rebates decreased from 2011 to 2012, but the savings were felt on the front end as insurers charged less in premiums. Consumers saved $3.44 billion in premiums in 2012, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which monitors the MLR. North Carolina consumers are in line to receive nearly $10 million in rebates, with 2/3 of those rebates going to United Healthcare customers. United is an operating division of Minneapolis-based United Health Group, the largest single health carrier in the United States. The largest insurer by market share in North Carolina is Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, which collected $5 billion in premiums last year. It paid enough in medical claims during the year, so it will not give out a rebate. Last year, health insurers owed $7 million in rebates, though that was thanks to a special waiver received thanks to a request made by North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin. Originally, the MLR rebate would have come to $12 million. United Healthcare provides coverage to more than 27 million Americans. Our total 2012 MLR rebate would amount to approximately $15 per person if spread evenly across our entire commercially insured population enrolled in a health plan eligible for a rebate, said a company spokesman. And now we turn to the spotlight section in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. The spotlight is on downtown Durham. The first article is headlined, Monsanto Buy Reiterates Area's Biotech Clout. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Durham. Near the hustle and bustle of the Durham Performing Arts Center and the sunshine-loving crowds at Durham Bulls Athletic Park, researchers at an agrobiotech giant are hiding in plain sight. Thanks to a recent acquisition, the genetic modifier Monsanto officially has a presence downtown. The company quietly nabbed Grassroots Biotechnology, a Duke University spinoff located in the Venerable Center downtown, a startup that has grown to a 25-person headcount over its six-year history. And while it's not known how long the researchers will be housed downtown, at present the Bull City Company is an official arm of the ag giant. Grassroots Biotechnology, founded by COO Doug Eisner and Duke University researcher Philip Benfey, is researching special DNA segments called promoters, segments that can determine when and where a genetic trait is expressed within a plant. Since 2009, the firm has partnered with Monsanto, acting as a research arm. The deal is something Eisner has been working toward in a way since founding the company in 2007, shortly after completing his MBA at Duke. We started going to ag biotechs to see if we could get a collaboration going, he explains. But that's not the only place he sought financing. An initial $150,000 grant from the National Science Foundation and a matching $100,000 grant from the state made the partnership push possible, he says. And entrepreneurs, he advises, should learn from his methodology. Explore all the avenues of funding because to start a biotech company and to develop research, it's very costly, he says, adding that biotechnology in agriculture is similar to drug development in that it takes years and millions to commercialize. You have to explore funding, and one great source of that is government grants. Next came the partnership, the result of multiple inquiries before nabbing Monsanto interest. The partnership, originally intended to last 3 years, aimed to source genetic elements that could enable crops to increase yields. Specifically, Grassroots sourced promoters for Monsanto's research team. In the initial 2009 announcement, Monsanto said it would use the promoters in a broad range of crops including corn, soy, cotton, and canola. A robust promoter toolbox can further leverage Monsanto's extensive gene library and lead to the development of more biotechnology-based crop products with a greater number of characteristics such as higher yield and tolerance to insects, weeds, and other stresses, Steve Padgett, Vice President of Biotechnology for Monsanto, said at the time. That partnership was extended in 2011, leading into the buy that closed June 14 of this year. Eisner couldn't be specific about the outcome of the collaboration, but said that the research produced is currently in play in Monsanto's research pipeline. The plant biotech world is somewhat like the drug world in that it takes more than 10 years, many dollars to get things into the field, he explains. Our products are somewhere along that pipeline and will eventually be commercialized. A cash breakdown of the deal was not disclosed, but research employees were transferred to Monsanto as part of the deal. And the next article in our spotlight, Growing Amid Thunder Lightning. And this article is also written by Lauren K. Onsorge. Want to start a multi-million dollar company that people will remember? Solve a problem. That's what worked for Phil Blizzard, CEO of the pet products company Thunderworks in downtown Durham. Blizzard had a big problem. A 50-pound problem named Dosey. And the solution? A company that would later grow to 32 employees and get a plethora of national exposure. She has been afraid of thunder and fireworks since she was a puppy, he says of the family dog Dosey. Afraid being an understatement of sorts when a midnight storm hits. I'd wake up with a 50-pound dog on my chest looking at me, shaking, panting, trembling. He did what most people do, he says, veterinary visits, training sessions, medication. It was pretty miserable for the dog, pretty miserable for me personally, he recalls. Finally, a family friend inspired a solution, putting Dosie in a tight wrap that would fit snugly around her torso. It's kind of like swaddling an infant, he says. He was skeptical at first, so skeptical, in fact, that he might never have tried it until a particularly bad storm hit. My wife was like, "We're trying this," he recalls. He says, recalling the day in 2008 that he wrestled Dosie into an old T-shirt and taped it around her torso. It was like flipping a switch. She laid right down. Blizzard was curious, was this something that could work for all pets? Between projects, the .com entrepreneur decided to take a chance, teaming up with three friends to bootstrap the product that would become Thundershirts. The website went live in May 2009. Initially, the management team worked with veterinarians and trainers. Skepticism was the biggest problem, he says. We knew they were the most important endorsers. Most people thought this was some kind of scam. Veterinary trade shows followed, and then, in early 2011, Blizzard and team started selling on television. That's when PetSmart and Petco contacted them. Today, more than 9,000 pet stores nationwide carry Thundershirt products. And what started as a single-color option product, gray, has morphed into multiple color selections, a cat Thundershirt option, and other canine products such as the Thunder Leash, Thunder Toy, and Thunder Treat. ThunderWorks is now headquartered at what was the Elkins Mitsubishi building near the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. The company also occupies most of what was Elkins Chrysler, about 25,000 square feet. We've been slowly taking more and more of the two buildings, he says. With the triple-digit growth the company has been experiencing year over year, an expansion may be needed soon, he says. While he won't release revenue numbers, he will say the company has helped over a million dogs. But skepticism about the product is still out there. That's where customers come in, talking up the product with fellow pet owners, he says. Derek Gagnier, a performance theater professor at Appalachian State University, is one of the converts. His basset hound, Tallulah, was terrified of storms. After seeing a Thundershirt advertised in a pet merchandise magazine, he and wife Laura decided to give it a try. She didn't shiver and was much less timid. Jessica McLoyn, founder of Raleigh Bakery Jessie Cakes, says it's hilariously effective on her cat. I died laughing the first time I put it on her because the cat just falls over and doesn't move, she says. That fall-over effect has propelled the popularity further, Blizzard says, pointing to a popular viral YouTube video that was shown on morning shows across the country. Just search for cat and Thundershirt, he says. And with our remaining 5 minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Cerberus Capital makes bid for Harris Teeter. Cerberus Capital Management has made a bid for Matthews-based grocery chain Harris Teeter Supermarkets Incorporated, according to the Wall Street Journal. The New York private equity firm has not yet decided whether to acquire Harris Teeter as a whole or to buy a piece of the supermarket chain and leave the rest in the hands of shareholders, the WSJ reports, citing a person familiar with the talks. Both Cerberus and Harris Teeter have previously declined to comment on a potential deal between the companies. Late this morning, Harris Teeter cited a statement it issued in February confirming that it was considering its options but offered no further comment. UNC Chapel Hill tapped for project to bolster STEM education. UNC Chapel Hill will serve as project site for a five-year initiative to improve undergraduate STEM education. Many in academia promote the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics because of their real-world applicability. Also, industries in those fields tend to have lower unemployment rates and hire more students right out of college. The Association of American Universities will give $500,000 to 8 campuses in the next 3 years as part of a $4.7 million grant to AAU from the Leona M. and Harry B. Helmsley Charitable Trust. Wake County building permits climb higher in May. Residential construction in Wake County was tempered a bit in May compared to April's record high number of building permits, but new commercial building construction posted its best month in a year. Building permits, an indication of future construction, grew 5% overall in May for all residential and commercial projects compared to the year prior, according to a report from the Wake County Revenue Department. The dollar value of the buildings listed on permits overall was up 22.2% in May, led by building permits for new commercial construction projects, which was up 46% in May, for a total of $55 million. Residential building permit value was up 20% in May, for a total value of $119.7 million. Raleigh among top 10 cities in which to get rich. Raleigh tied with Houston at number 9 in a new listing of the nation's 10 best cities in which to get rich. The survey was performed by Pasadena, California-based CreditDonkey.com, which arrived at its ranking by looking at three factors: high income percentage, GDP growth, and patent numbers. Raleigh posted a 11.3%, 10.2%, and 1,197 on those three metrics, respectively. The number one city was San Jose, with a high income percentage of 25%, growth rate of 18%, and patent count of 10,256. North Carolina House Committee pulls plug on anti-Tesla bill. A bill that would ban sales of cars directly to consumers was blocked by a North Carolina House Committee Tuesday, effectively shutting down what some view as the North Carolina Automobile Dealers Association's anti-Tesla campaign. It didn't come as a surprise, said Tesla Motors Director of Public Policy Jim Chen, who attended Tuesday's meeting. What this does is it enables Tesla to continue to sell cars. It's not changing existing law. What the dealer bill sought to do was preclude us from doing that. The Senate's Commerce Committee unanimously approved the bill in May as part of a package that would update franchise dealer regulations. And we're going to stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.